I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. If you're in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia, you might come across the Eaton family working on a 42-foot wooden schooner. It's a project they began 8 years ago with plans to launch the boat in the Delaware River in the fall and then possibly a sail across the Atlantic Ocean. Needless to say, it's an ambitious project, but not the first boat that they have built together. The first one was a 12-foot dinghy in the late 1980s, with several others in between. We were intrigued when we heard the story, knowing that many of us harbor fantasies about taking on something that really pushes us beyond our limits. So we have invited a father-son team to join us here on Radio Times. Bob Eaton is with us. He's the director of Survey Action Center. That's an international NGO established to conduct national surveys locating landmine fields in over 15 war-affected countries, and one of the workers and builders of this boat. And Bob Eaton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us, his son, Jonah Eaton, who's now a lawyer here in Philadelphia. And Jonah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much.
And Bob, can I assume that you are a sailor and a lover of the sea because you named your son Jonah?
Yeah. Yeah, contrary to tradition. But Jonah got a bad rap in the Bible.
It's a terrible name for a boat builder.
Jonah was innocent, and they threw him overboard, and he was an innocent guy.
I was just wondering about how this name came about. But clearly, you're a family that loves boats. Did you grow up with boats, Bob?
Yeah. And part of why I think this boat is, we're building this boat now, my father bought us a 12-foot used sailboat a long time ago in the 50s, and he saw the ad in the paper, and he called up, and he said, and the guy said, go down to the beach and it'll be right there in a mooring. So we went down to the beach and there was no boat, and there was a little payphone right there. So we called the guy up and he says, well, look, there's no boat. And he says, oh, is it high tide? And we said, yeah, well, yeah. He says, well, just wait. And sure enough, the tide went out, and there was this
there was the boat at the bottom
sitting
on the water.
Sitting on the bottom. Well, we learned boat maintenance pretty quick, and we've been doing it ever since.
Now, I read, Jonah, that it started with a smaller boat than the one you're working on now, which I do want to talk about, but a 12-foot dinghy. The idea is that as a family, you would build a boat together.
Yeah, well, I guess the mythology is one Christmas my mother gave my dad a set of plans for a cat's paw dinghy, which is a little 12-foot rowing sailing boat. And we started that Christmas day. My dad and my granddad started tearing up bookshelves to make the molds, and it's kind of been a long roll downhill since then.
And as I said, we will get to the boat that you're building on now. But, I mean, have you always been handy? Or are you someone who's good with tools, for instance, Bob?
I don't know about good with tools, but, you know, ever since, in fact, the 50s, you know, in the 50s, it was a different culture here in America. Popular Mechanics was a really popular magazine, and there were projects there. People built things. That's what you did on the weekends. I remember, you know, we had a neighbor who was a radio technician or something, and we went in his basement, this kid's, you know, in sixth grade, and we built a crystal radio and stuff. I mean, people built things. We soldered things, and we did things with our hands. And now you just go to the big box stores, and you buy stuff off the shelf, and the minute it goes wrong, you throw it away and buy another one. And so in a way, I don't know whether I could say we're good at this, but we work at it.
Jonah, describe.
We're certainly not fast at it.
No, this has been an 8-year project, but I realize you're close to the end here. Describe this boat that you're working on, Jonah.
Okay, well, this is a John Alden Malabar 2/3, which was originally designed in 1922 by John Alden, and it's a derivative design of old New England fishing schooners, which had sort of several properties that, you know, results in a really very beautiful and very seaworthy hull. You know, they have big sort of full bows that can take nasty weather, and then they sort of what's called the sheer, which is basically the line of the deck, kind of dramatically sort of swoops down to a low point back towards the end of the boat, for the very practical reason that if you're hauling nets or hauling fish lines, you want it to be close to the water as possible, because that's one less foot of pulling you had to do.
Why this design, though? What was intriguing or challenging or interesting about this design?
I don't know. It's pretty.
It's just beautiful. Yeah. It's just beautiful. Anybody who knows boats will tell you this is an authentic sort of American-Canadian North Atlantic design, and it developed over the years, and there is a simplicity and a grace to this that almost has never been equaled on sailing boats. And almost even the manufacturers of plastic boats will sort of sigh when they hear about this kind of schooner.
Well, I read about it. It's a 42 feet long, I guess a little bit longer with the, what is that, the
bowsprit.
Bowsprit. Yeah. 14 tons, two-masted, all done by hand and by scratch. Is that pretty much describe what you've been doing for 8 years?
When we made the decision to do it, we were out in Wisconsin, and we visited a farmer and picked the logs to be sawn up to begin the project with. So this farmer sawed them up and air-dried them for us, and we hauled them back here. So it's been hands-on. The only labor that we've paid for on this boat has been to rebuild the engine that we salvaged from a boat that was headed towards the deep. And because we're not diesel mechanics, but otherwise it's been all our own labor and an amazing number of volunteers.
Yeah.
Well, and your building or your wood shop, I don't even know what, garage or whatever.
Wood shop. We call it the shop.
The shop. This is in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a lot of neighborhood interest in what's going on in this place.
Yeah, we got these big old 14 foot by 14 foot sort of rolling door. That we can open up, sort of slides over, and then the whole neighborhood kind of look in and see what we're up to. We've been at it long enough. There's even been some turnover. Some people moved out,
and some new people moved in. Renewed interest in what you're doing.
We're watching children grow up.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So where do you start? I mean, if you're building a 42 foot boat, what's the first thing you do?
So John Alden's Naval Architecture Company was actually still in business in Boston. So you call them up and you order a set of plans. Plans, unfortunately, were not very detailed. But the most important thing you get is called the Table of Offsets, which is a bunch of XY coordinates. They're just numbers. And you build a big floor that's bigger than the actual boat. And you sort of plot out all these XY coordinates, and you spring long, flexible pieces of wood between them. And then you generate a series of curves, and that basically defines the shape of the boat. And so then once you have that, you can start making patterns to those curves and then constructing actual boat. Yeah, so we probably had, many, many months of labor that just went into sort of molds and patterns that has mostly been discarded now, unfortunately, because we didn't have space for them.
But having been a sailor in my past, I mean, there are very few straight lines when it comes to a boat. Everything is curved.
No straight lines, hardly any right angles. Everything is a curve. And you learn very quickly that building a house is a pleasure because everything's right angles on most houses, but not on a boat, which is what makes it interesting because you're always bending wood, and the wood is always under a kind of a tension. But, by the way, this pattern making that Jonah referred to, it's the exact same process when we built our 12-foot dinghy. It's the same process when they build aircraft carriers.
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't change. You have to go to a floor, and you have to have that floor as long as the boat is long. And you have to plot out the curves.
Do you have a lot of complicated tools in your building?
No, it's nothing that flashy. I mean, it's just sort of at this point, I mean, you take long enough, you accumulate tools. I mean, we just got a very, a reasonably well-equipped wood shop. But, yeah, nothing very fancy, nothing very high-end, so.
And what was I'm curious, I mean, you're almost done, but what has been the most challenging part of building this schooner?
Well, the most challenging part right now is we're leaving the world of woodworking, which we know, into the world of diesel mechanics and all that kind of stuff. So that's challenging. I'm up every night reading electrical manuals about wiring this boat and so on. Before that, the most challenging thing for sure, I think, was pouring a 4-ton keel of molten lead. We had some wonderful volunteers, and we ran around to tire shops and got the lead weights, which they throw away when they replace your tires. These little lead weights are about the size of your pinky finger, and we salvaged a boat, cut up its keel, we threw it into bathtubs, and melted the thing down with propane torches.
Are we allowed to do this in Philadelphia?
Well, this is an interesting question.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a statute of limitations. Don't tell OSHA.
Although we had OSHA masks on, but I got to tell you, it's all of a sudden this bathtub, which has all this scrap iron in it, which is smoldering, by the way, because it's dirty stuff and stuff. It looks like you probably think hell looks like before they plunge you into
it.
There's this molten stuff on the top. It's smoking and stuff. But all of a sudden, a critical mass is hit, and it turns liquid, and it's like a bath of mercury. It's unbelievable. And then you open the spigot, and it pours out just like water into your mold, and the mold catches fire immediately. And the hope is it cools off before the mold catches fire and spills molten lead all over the shop floor and encases your feet.
We had done this before.
That was my next question. Did you run for the hills when you were waiting for this to happen? But what's interesting, Jonah, is that the kind of, I guess, recycling part of this project. Certainly, I guess, when it came to the metals that you needed.
Well, all kinds of stuff. I mean, we've demolished two other smaller boats in the process of building this big one. Probably the big mistake we made before we started is not getting fabulously wealthy. Before we built this thing, all this hardware is very expensive. So we went out and, you know, people, in one case, a guy had a boat at Penn's Landing that was just slowly sinking. So he just gave it to me.
Really?
So we hauled it over to the Pine Point Boatyard over in Camden and chopped it into pieces. Took all the lead off of that and some hardware. And then we had another boat that was down in Annapolis or outside of Annapolis that also was never going to float again. We chopped that into pieces, and took lead and but also a lot of bronze hardware, sort of, you know, cleats and winches and, you know, things of that nature. But if you were to buy it new, it just cost, you know, a fortune.
right, because we're talking metal here. But I'm just curious about how much research you did, or was it just sort of trusting your instincts or trusting each other that you could do some of these what sound like sort of dangerous things?
Well, every task is new, so we sort of scratch our heads, and maybe if there's some literature to read, we read it, and we sort of invent ourselves. And by the time we're through with that particular task, we actually get pretty good at it. But then it's only in the last part of it we're actually good at it. And then that's done, and there's a new task. We have to re-educate ourselves. So it's always a constant re-educating ourselves, finally getting good. And then when we get good, we're done, which is the difference between what we're doing, what a professional boatyard would do, because they actually are good from the beginning. We have to sort of ramp ourselves up to being good. And frankly, we are. It's a beautiful boat, and and people would look at it and say it's professionally done. But we see all the scrapes and scratches on the boat and in our hands where we were on that ramped up learning curve.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Bob and Jonah Eaton about a project that they've been working on here in Philadelphia in the Frankfurt section of the city. They are building a 42-foot, 14-ton, two-masted wooden schooner by hand from scratch in an old building, and they've been working on it for 8 years. They're going to launch it in October in the Delaware River, and we do want to take some calls here because we know others have been intrigued, as we have been, with this project and some of the DIY nature of it. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we don't exactly do good radio. We do the radio we can get away with.
All right. This is great. The show's already off the rails. We haven't even started it yet.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz that never goes where it's supposed to. Saturdays at 4 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Gogol Bordello frontman Eugene Hoots is against borders, physical or otherwise. That's why he likes what music does for people.
They don't have to think about who they are, what are they going to do. They don't have to think about any of that. They actually become who they truly are.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about building a boat from scratch, which our guests Bob and Jonah Eaton have been doing with their family, with some friends and neighbors as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Bob, you should probably give a shout-out to your wife, who's probably listening to this, just so, yeah. So we don't forget her in this conversation here.
Right.
You could be in big trouble,
definitely
I think.
Listening
the
to
fact
this.
Is, she's listening to us now in the shop where she's varnishing the beams for the cabin top.
Hi, Mom.
But this is a family project, yes.
It is, very much so. Wendy and I, my wife, came down from Maine where we live in April.
We kind of live in Maine.
We've been here since April 1st in this final push to get the boat in the water. So Wendy and I are working 6 days a week just all the time. And Jonah comes in because he's got a day job and works in the evenings and weekends with us.
And did you think this was going to take 8 years?
Got to ask that. Throw it over to Jonah. I told Jonah it was about a 2-year project when he was young. He was young and naive, and because Jonah worked full time on this thing for what, 4 years?
Almost five. Yeah.
Almost 5 years. Full time before he went off to law school.
Right.
Yeah, but mostly working alone. It's very inefficient way to go about it.
And figuring all this stuff out? I mean, yourself. I mean, knowing you had your dad and your family, I guess.
Yeah, it's the figuring out stuff. And then also when you're on your own, it's like in the early stages, you know, you've got a 250, 300-pound piece of keel that you have to maneuver and sort of shift around the shop. So you spend half of the day, you know, with winches and levers and, you know, just trying to put it into position. it's definitely easier with more hands. But yeah, we have fallen back. You know, I've got three younger siblings, and they've all pitched in at various points and at varying levels of enthusiasm.
And they know who they are, right?
Exactly. They know who they are. And just, you know, great, you know, I got a huge group of friends here. And, there was like when we were planking, there were three friends who were in the shop almost every weekend for a couple of months, sort of helping me lay up planks. I had another friend who, she worked part-time in the shop and sort of part-time at a coffee shop, you know. And so that was a big help. So, yeah, this has been a real community effort too, I think.
Well, since your father and son here, I mean, do you think this boat building, and this is the last of several boats you've built together, is there something about a father and son doing this together that we should know about? About your
and
relationship,
mother.
As we say?
And mother.
Okay, and mother.
Well, I think
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's been a family project that's been led by Jonah. Although, you know, when we launch this boat, we're going to motor it up to Maine, and then we're going to build the spars and do the interior work. It's much like building a house, you know. People say, wow, that was easy. The frame and the siding went up, and then all of the things slow down while the plumbing and the electrical and the sheetrocking and the flooring.
Which will go much faster than 8 years, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. We're going to knock this sucker out in about 9 months.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I want to hear.
Famous last words, right?
But it is a family project, and I think all of us are very proud of that. We have a close-knit family, our kids grew up mostly overseas while Wendy and I were working for the United Nations and for the Quakers. And I think we've always been a close-knit family, but I think this is sort of a source of real family pride.
Mm. Well, the idea of building something together, yeah. I mean, literally building a boat together.
Yeah, and, you know, I was thinking about it as I was sweeping out the shop floor. I mean, probably half the wood that comes into that shop leaves as chips and sawdust. I mean, it's shaping stuff and just taking this sort of inert piece of wood and shaping it into something beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely thing to do.
Jonah, is the plan to sail this across the Atlantic, and then we'll get to some of our callers?
That was always the plan from day one. I mean, back in, 2004, 2005, when we were first sort of thinking about it, I was working as an engineer just here in Old City, and I was bored a little bit. So we sort of decided that we were going to build a boat, and we're going to sail it to Narvik, Norway, which is up north of the Arctic Circle. For reasons I'll let my dad explain. Yeah. And then maybe go into the Mediterranean as it got cold.
To kind of
so that's still the game plan, you know, someday. I mean, obviously, you know, I made the terrible mistake of getting myself a career, so that's going to slow things down.
You are
down.
Now a lawyer, yes. Why Norway? And then we'll get to our callers.
Well, my job is running around the world surveying landmine fields. And as it turns out, there's an amazing number of Norwegians involved in that process worldwide. And so I've gotten to know, and a bunch of them come from up in the north in the Arctic Circle area. So, and I just talking to them says, we want to go up there and see the midnight sun during the solstice. And then the Croatian coast, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Croatia are full of landmines. And I've been there a lot helping them map them so they can be destroyed. And we've met an awful, amazing number of wonderful people down there. So we have friends that are sort of professionally related in different places. So it's sort of a dream to go visit them.
Yeah, I got someone in Ireland now in Galicia, Spain. So you sort of got the
And have you ever sailed the across route. The Atlantic?
Never sailed the Atlantic. I spent a year aboard a cargo sailing ship taking medical supplies to North and South Vietnam during the war as part of a Quaker project. But no, never crossed the Atlantic. That'll be a first.
Well, yeah,
but South China Seas, it's not, you know, it's nothing to shake a stick at.
No, indeed. But let me get some callers in. And again, we're talking about building a boat in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia. And our guests are father, son, Bob and Jonah Eaton. And the boat is a 42-foot, 14-ton, two-masted wooden schooner based on a design that goes back about 100 years or so. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have Hallie from, looks like Jenkintown, joining us on Radio Times. Hallie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And thank you for the amazing work that you do finding landmines across the world.
Indeed.
A real dedication. Thank you. My brother-in-law used to work for Goujon Brothers up in Bay City, Michigan, and he and an engineer from NASA had designed a 16-foot bay sailor, and they built one for the engineer, and then my brother-in-law started his, and it got about halfway done, and then he gave it to us, and we've had it for 27 years.
Oh, my goodness.
I've named it the Albatross.
Yeah.
And my husband is a woodworker, and he's lost his inspiration and his momentum. Any suggestions how we can get
inspire
this
him
along again, or would you like a 16-foot bay sailor?
For your next project, I hear
think
you
we've
have
got our hands full
yeah,
right
Jonah,
now.
Yeah, Jonah. Any words of inspiration, Bob?
I think the only inspiration I could find for that project is probably a good bottle of Irish whiskey.
but it's a great project. You just got to keep on plugging away at it. I mean, I cannot express to you the sort of, you know, depths of frustration we've you know, occasionally felt on this thing, but yeah,
somehow you muscle through,
yeah,
right?
Just keep on plugging away. Yeah, you guys should come out to the launch. Maybe that'll fill you full of hope.
And I appreciate the call because you just told us how to pronounce the Goujon brothers' name. we read their book all the time on epoxy.
Oh, they specialize in epoxy?
Oh, yeah, these are the guys that invented the field.
Oh, interesting. Hallie, thanks for the call, and good luck to you as well. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What's the name of your boat?
Aramingo.
Aramingo, because of Aramingo Avenue in Philly?
Yeah, because of the street, exactly.
And it's nice because it's the original Indian word for the area, which is a place where the wolf walks.
Yeah. And you have a date when you're going to launch this boat in the Delaware?
Yes, we do. You know, we've
you have
made
to speak
we've
with
made,
more confidence, Jonah.
Well, I mean, we've got an 8-year track record of missing deadlines, but this one, I think, even I'm the skeptic, feels reasonably good about. So yeah, we're gonna truck it down to the Delaware and plop it in the water and see if it floats.
Yeah,
it'll float.
The deadline's firm because whether it floats or not, it's going in the water on the 5th of October. That's the end of it. If it sinks, it was a nice project and we enjoyed it. If it floats, we're very happy.
It'll
but it's
float.
Going in the water on the 5th.
It'll float.
Do you have any question about whether it'll float or not?
We're very confident it will.
It'll float. I mean, it's more you worry about, you know, will the engine turn over or, you know, maybe there'll be some – there's always like little problems that'll – you know, kinks that got to be worked out of the system when you first put it in. So.
Does it have sails? I mean, are we that far along?
Not yet, but we got a sewing machine, so we'll get there eventually.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Tim from Bluebell joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm good.
I wondered if your guests know of Bret Hart, who runs a wonderful wooden boat factory at Globe Dye Works called the Wooden Boat Factory. It's just a great project with a lot of craftsmen, and I would think they're right in the neighborhood.
We are actually on the same block. We've got kind of a boat builder's row going on up there. Me and Bret have known each other for quite a while. And also, I guess Bret knew John Braxton. I mean, there's sort of like Quaker connections going back. me and Bret have, you know, visited each other's shops many times and, you know, lent the occasional tool. We helped him, in fact, pour a ballast keel for a boat he's working on a year and a half ago.
We have a great connection with the Independent Seaport Museum wooden boat shop there. So it seems like there's a fledgling boat community here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, no, there's some, you know, it's not New England, but there are some very good boat builders in this town. Yeah, I've known John Brady over at the Seaport Museum for years.
Yeah, and he's been very helpful to us when need arises.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah, Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did you grow up in New England? Is that your connection to?
Grew up in Connecticut.
Okay.
And then moved down in high school time, moved down to Chesapeake Bay, actually.
Which is, of course, great for sailing.
Taught sailing, actually, in summers and so on.
Was there a point, I mean, it sounds like you have muscled through whatever problems may have arisen, but was there ever a point where you felt like, it's just too much, and it's just overwhelming? I'm tossing that to you, Jonah.
No. Not sort of in the long term. I mean, you know, you get frustrated, you go home.
Oh, is that right?
Sleep it off and then go back at it the next day, I guess.
Yeah. And have you always been a kind of determined family?
Yeah, and I think Jonah probably has more tenacity than the rest of us put together. So we picked well when we suggested he start this project.
Let me see what looks like John from Kensington has to say. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hey, yeah. I was actually. Hi. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You started to hint on what my question was, and I was going to ask, like, during this whole 8-year project, was there any point where you thought the whole thing was going to be a total failure or, that it just wasn't going to happen, or if there was some big problem that arose, and how you sort of were able to persevere through that, if that was the case.
John, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Jonah.
Well, I think the two scariest moments were, we actually started off in Kensington. Our first shop was at 2nd and York, and that shop was a bit of a disaster.
Why so?
Basically the roof was collapsing around our ears, to make a long story short. So, yeah, we had these repeated roof collapses, and then the landlord went bankrupt and sort of told us on fairly short notice that we were going to have to vacate. That was definitely... That sort of felt mission threatening for a while there because we had to find a new space to put it in. Then we found this place in Frankfurt, and it's worked out. It's worked out great. It's dry. The roof is in beautiful condition, so that's been good. Although the second was we had a break in a little over a year. Less than a year ago. And all that bronze hardware I was talking about, a good portion of it got stolen, which just is heartbreaking. I mean, it was 50, 60-year-old, castings that, got sold for pennies on the dollar for scrap.
How'd they get in?
There was someone breaking. It's one of these block sort of spanning kind of industrial complexes that got built up over, probably 100 years. And so they were breaking in probably at a far corner. They took out a lot of copper piping, too, and just no one was the wiser. And eventually they found our way into our area.
And you had all this...
We have this stuff just lying around. It's not lying around anymore. Most of it lives in my basement down in... That was extremely demoralizing because, we didn't have the money to buy this stuff new. In that case, we launched a Kickstarter campaign and, friends and total strangers kicked in. We got back to where we were, sort of a 2-month setback probably.
But a successful campaign.
Successful. That's good. We got a new rudder post out of that. That was probably the biggest loss. And new port lights, which frankly probably better than the ones they stole. There's an anchor roller we still haven't sorted out yet. Yeah. That was probably the lingering loss that still hurts, but we'll figure something out.
I'm curious about how much money have you spent on this? The idea I was realized was to spend as little as possible, but when all is said and done.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been very careful to keep good records. We have every receipt pretty much, but we've also been very careful never to add it up. What we know is at the end of every month, there's still money in the checking account, so it's okay. We're paying the rent, we're paying the electricity, and we're paying the boat. So it's good.
So it must be working.
It's all good.
Well, it's great to live in a delusion, isn't it?
Yeah, right. And the labor's free.
Right. And that helps as well. How do you move a 14-ton boat? And I know the plan is to, you know, to launch it in the Delaware.
Yeah, well, they make these special rigs that are kind of two long rails that you can back up on either side of the keel, and they've got hydraulics built into them, and they'll just jack the boat up off the ground, and you drive away with it, and then back it into the water. So you know, it'll be a little more harrowing than that, but that's the basic, plan, yeah.
And do you have a celebration plan for that launch?
Yeah, there's going to be a really good party after that.
Is that right? Very important. Very important. And is this the last boat the Eaton family is going to be building, Bob?
Well, there's one small project which I've taken on, which is to build a little dinghy for the boat, a little 11-foot dinghy that will serve the boat as a tender. I started a project with some neighborhood kids about the time we laid the keel for the main boat, and that little dinghy project with the neighborhood kids was, that'd be a great finger exercise, and then I could do a really good one later after the neighborhood kids screwed up the first one. Well, that project took 7 years. The neighborhood kids all grew up right underneath this boat, but I haven't started it. So there's one small project to go, but it's not a deal breaker.
Three or four months.
Yeah, for sure.
That's easy.
Especially if you're up in Maine and those winters roll in. There's absolutely nothing to do.
That's right.
So this has been a good project for the Eaton family. I mean, we're laughing a lot now.
the great thing, Marty, is we're in this air conditioned studio right now.
We're not up in
the shop, and when you get up high up near the ceiling to work on the boat where it goes to 99 degrees, yeah, we're feeling pretty good right now.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago it was like 95 degrees in there at 9 p.m. at night. Yeah. Well, awful.
I know you've been coughing. I mean, is that a occupational hazard?
He doesn't wear a mask. That's why.
Is that right?
Yeah, we inhale an amazing amount of sawdust and so on. Yeah, part of this boat's with me right now.
It's in our lungs
for sentimental reasons.
Yeah, yeah. I feel good about that.
Well, I congratulate you on this amazing project, and I thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been our pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well, and we get to fantasize about something that you're actually doing. And our guests have been Bob and Jonah Eaton, and we've been talking about a 42-foot, 14-ton, two-masted wooden schooner they're building in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia. Coming up, we'll be talking about some of the Pope's comments earlier this week. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This week on This American Life.
Okay, you had me pick up dandelions just to prove a point to me.
So you're still upset over the dandelion deal?
Yes, I really am.
An inmate and a prison guard tell each other how they really feel.
It wasn't hard. It was just.
Did it take a lot of time?
No, it didn't take a lot of time. It's still the principle. You made me pick up.
Did you break any bones?
No.
How your perspective changes when you're stuck inside a situation. This week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, as Congress prepares for its August recess, we talk with Jonathan Weissman, who covers Congress for the New York Times.
We are really on pace to have one of the least productive, if not the least productive, Congresses in history.
Weissman will explain why and talk about the showdowns expected this fall. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The Private and His Very Public Trial.
It's the most important court-martial trial since Milei. It's the most important case involving government secrets since the Pentagon Papers.
Bradley Manning faces the music in the biggest leak of classified information in U.S. history next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Pope Francis made headlines this week flying back from Brazil when he told reporters that he wouldn't judge gay priests if they're seeking the Lord in good faith, and when he called for a deeper theology about women. We asked Father Jim Martin to join us. He's a Jesuit priest, culture editor of America Magazine, author of a number of books. And Jim Martin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So was it the fact of what the Pope said, how he said it, where he said it, that he said it, that has created all these headlines?
Well, I think mostly that he said it and how he said it. I think, first of all, he used the word gay, which popes generally have not used, bishops generally do not use. They usually say homosexual, homosexually oriented, same sex. He talked about gay priests positively when in 2005 there was a document saying that gay men could not be admitted to seminaries. There were no negative condemnations of gay people. And also, if you listen to the original Italian, the tone is very pastoral and warm. Andrew Sullivan, the commentator yesterday on his website, said that it moved into tears. And one of it was just sort of, one of the reasons was just sort of listening to the Pope's words and his affect. So I think all those things taken together have really surprised people.
And I guess the gay part has gotten most of the headlines. But was it his acknowledgement that there are gay priests in the Catholic Church? Was that important as well by using those words?
Well, I think so. I don't think anyone has ever sort of doubted that. You know, there are many healthy and faithful and celibate gay priests in the Catholic Church. I think it was simply the way that he was talking about gay people in general, because he moved very quickly in that very brief comment. Someone asked him about a gay lobby in the Vatican, and he moved very quickly to talking about gay people. He didn't say gay priests are, you know, who am I to judge them? He said, una persona gay, you know, who am I to judge, you know, that person? So it was more generally about gay people, which I think pretty much shocked everybody.
One of the, and there, you know, there's always criticism when somebody says something, including now Pope Francis, but some have said that he really was just reinforcing church doctrine because he was acknowledging gay priests in the Catholic Church, but he wasn't saying that they can engage in if I can say this, you know, in sexual activities. It was kind of love the sinner, hate the sin.
Well, not exactly. I mean, you know, clearly, you know, priests are supposed to be celibate. I'm celibate. I take a vow of chastity, too, as a member of a religious order. And he wasn't changing any church doctrine. But, you know, what was notable was this positive statement. And frankly, saying, who am I to judge a gay person is quite new for anyone in the church to say. And once again, the tone was really striking. So, you know, notice also that in that short statement, he did not say, you know, as well, gay people are intrinsically disordered, they're objectively disordered, they're this, they're that. It was purely a, who am I to judge, you know, my brother or sister, you know, who is, as he said in a quote, you know, seeking God with goodwill. I mean, it was an entirely positive sort of presentation, you know, of a gay person by a pope. You know, who, frankly, you were talking about the sort of setting, you know, who was, you know, handling every question that was thrown at him for an hour and a half. A friend of mine is an AP reporter, and she said it was insane, and she meant it in the best possible way.
Because popes just don't do that?
Well, I think it was completely unscripted. It was long, you know, after this long week in Rio, and apparently they were going through some turbulence at the time. I think what she meant was it was so freewheeling. And you're right, most of the times that popes handle questions like that, they're a little more carefully screened. And he's just, he's very comfortable. He's a very free person, I think, and is happy to take any and all questions from journalists and from kids. You know, there was a couple times that he's taken questions from kids that were unscripted, and he was happy to respond.
Well, we're talking about what the Pope said this week, and if you want to give us a call, and we invite you to do so, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jim, one of the things that was a bit under the radar, you caught it, I didn't, it really had to do with Catholics who divorce. What did the Pope say about them?
Well, I think you're right. You know, all the sort of focus was on gays, but he talked about divorced and remarried Catholics, which is a group that, you know, really feels, many of them, marginalized from the Church. And he asked for mercy for them, and for, I think he said, a new epoch or a new era, depending on the translation, and said that he was setting up a commission to look at this question of these people. And so that was something else that I think shows a great deal of compassion. You know, very briefly, one of the hallmarks of his papacy has been the word mercy. He uses it over and over and over again, and he invites bishops and priests to be more merciful, and this is another example of that.
But is it a matter, do you think it's looking at annulment and sort of revisiting or even rethinking some of these, I guess, traditions within the Church?
Well, I think the question is this, that, you know, in general, divorced and remarried Catholics, you know, are not permitted to receive communion, and so as a result, you know, that's in most dioceses and in most parishes. That's a very complex question, but in general, that's how they feel. They don't feel welcome to take communion, and so the Pope is looking at this group of people who are a considerable number of people in the Catholic Church and saying, we need to look at this group and be more merciful. So it's actually more about the reception of communion and welcoming people back into communion with the Church, and the Pope has said he wants to look at that, which is quite remarkable.
Another thing he said, and I realize I'm working on translations as well, and this has to do with women in the Church, basically underscoring the tradition there, no to the ordination of women. The Church has spoken, but he also talked about we can't relegate women to just altar girls. And he also said women in the Church are more important than bishops and priests. I'm not a Catholic, so I'm just asking questions as an outsider here. He seems to be saying several what appear to be contradictory things about women in the Church.
Well, actually, one of the rather sort of ironic things is when he said not just altar girls. There are some dioceses where they're not allowed to be altar girls. I wonder what some of those pastors who heard the Pope say, hey, they can't be just altar girls. I have to think about that. He is saying, he's reiterating the Church's teaching that there will be no ordination of women. He quoted John Paul in saying that door is closed. But then he said, we need a deeper theology of women, which I found really striking because that implies that he doesn't think that the Church's theology of women is deep enough, which is quite a statement. He has talked before about, to your point, including women more in leadership roles. So, for example, even if a woman is not ordained, can she be the head of a Vatican congregation? You know, can she run a Vatican organization? Are there ways of bringing women into leadership roles, you know, more forcefully? So I think that's what he's looking at. As for women being more important than bishops and priests, I think he's actually, you know, we need to take him at his word. He believes that, you know, as mothers, as women in the Church, that's what he believes. It's a rather mysterious statement, but he referred to Mary, Jesus's mother, and said, you know, she's more important than bishops and priests, and I agree. So it's a, he is really trying to shake things up a bit. He said that in Rio. He wants to cause, in his words, a mess. And, he's succeeding.
Do you think that the nuns on the bus in any way have influenced the Pope's thinking on this issue?
I don't know specifically, but, you know, he is coming out of an archdiocese, Buenos Aires, which is a very large archdiocese. He's a Jesuit. He's had a lot of experience on the ground before that. So this is a man who's coming out of a lot of pastoral experience on the ground, I would say.
I got emails, I'm sure you did as well, including press releases for women that want the ordination of women in the Catholic Church. And while they welcome some of this language, they're still, I think, frustrated that the Pope wasn't willing to embrace their mission.
I think that's accurate. I think there are a lot of women that are frustrated. I think, you know, the churches argument against the ordination of women is basically that Jesus could have done it but didn't in terms of, you know, appointing the apostles. On the other hand, I know a lot of Catholic women who feel called to that. You know, that is perhaps the strongest argument, you know, on the other side. But I really do think that, I don't think that's going to change, you know, under his papacy. That's for sure. He's pretty clear about that. But the question is, are there ways of involving women in leadership roles that do not, you know, sort of require ordination? And I think he's very open to that, which I think is a very positive step forward.
He was asked about some of the financial scandals that the Vatican Bank. What did he say in response to those questions?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He said very honestly, he said, I'm trying my best. You know, we have people in there that are trying to change these things. I think he said, I may be misquoting him, but he said something like, I'm not sure how it's going to work out. You know, and I think that was very human and very honest. You know, he is in the role for a couple of months and he's trying his best to get a handle on it. It's very complicated, and I really appreciated that, frankly. He sort of said, I'm doing my best and I don't know how it's going to turn out, rather than trying to sweep it under the carpet. I found that press conference really moving. I mean, the whole trip in Rio, you know, I mean, I thought it kind of ironic that, you know, he preaches to 3.5 million people and that's on page like A5 in some newspapers, and he says the word gay and it's on the front page. But
what does that tell you?
I don't know. I'm a priest and a member of the media too, so I don't want to blame the media, but it did bother me a little bit that this sort of outpouring of faith, this kind of explosion of faith, you know, was not seen as newsworthy. I mean, those pictures from Rio were stunning. But, you know, I guess, you know, those are the times we live in. It is a, you know, the issue of gay rights is a big topic for people, so I understand that.
I saw those pictures as well, and I think that, I mean, several million, maybe as many as 3 million people on a beach. I don't even know how you can do that. And this was Copacabana, just to sort of add to the drama of what was going on in Rio.
Yes, or as they dubbed it down there, Copacabana.
Oh, they did? Oh, dear, really? And that was World Youth Day that was being celebrated in Rio.
It was. It was a whole week of events, and in addition to the masses and the vigils, the Pope also, I wish this had been covered more, went into a favela, a slum in Rio, and talked about social justice, economic inequalities, solidarity with the poor. It was an incredible moment of a Pope who has said, you know, I want a church that is poor and for the poor, really doing it, really trying to get his message across and being among the poor. I found that really moving.
And even looking back on the selection of this Pope, I mean, they must have known about his views of poverty. I mean, he seems to reject most of the pomp and circumstance that comes along with being the Pope.
Well, he does. I have to say, you know, he's a Jesuit, and I'm saying this on our feast day. The feast of St. Ignatius Loyola is today. You know, as a Jesuit and any religious order like the Franciscans, Dominicans, or Benedictines, men and women, you know, we take vows of poverty and we're supposed to live simply. And so part of that is when he got into his new role as the Pope, he said, I don't really think I need all these things. I don't need to live in the Apostolic Palace. I don't have to wear the red shoes. I don't really need a big car. He his official car is a 5-year-old Ford Focus, which I love. I put that on my public Facebook page, and someone said, "I'm so happy he's buying American," which I thought was kind of amusing. But yeah, he's very free. I think that they knew that they were going to get someone who was a free person, a person who would be able to confront a lot of problems, a person who had a common touch. I'm not sure that they knew that all these other things were going to come along with him. But, you know, as I like to tell people, the Holy Spirit knew, and, you know, we have someone who is, it seems to me, really guided by the Holy Spirit.
Let me see what Frank from Balakimwin has to say. Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Sure.
My question is this. I'm admiring the Pope since he was elected to the position, but a lot of what he does is, it seems to me, to be a bit more style than substance. On the gay issue, he had an opportunity to change the church's position, or at least say that he does not believe gay people are functionally disordered. He did not do that. He said nice words, but it doesn't change the church's harsh teaching. could you comment on that?
Frank, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say two things. I actually think style is substance. I think that the way he handles those questions and his pastoral tone and, you know, the words that he uses, what he chooses not to say, is substantial, and I think people are going to take note of that. And the second thing is, I think in terms of changing the church's teaching and sort of issuing, you know, kind of broad statements, I think a press conference is not the place where you're going to see church teaching changed, you know, in any shape, way, or form. But I do think that this is a huge step forward. You know, frankly, the fact that someone who I respect very much, someone like Andrew Sullivan, you know, a very prominent writer, essayist, thinker, intellectual, and openly gay person, you know, is moved to tears, tells me that something has happened and that actually the style is substantial.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jim, we have about a minute here, but would you say, though, another big test, or perhaps even the biggest test for this pope, is the church sex abuse scandal and how he deals with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the top three issues facing the church worldwide today, not just in the West. And, you know, he's talked about it, you know, and he's talked about, you know, how he wants to eradicate it. But, you know, what he's going to do, I think, remains to be seen. Absolutely. And I think he knows that. I mean, he was an archbishop. You know, he clearly had dealt with cases like that, and he certainly knows about it. So I'm looking forward to him kind of addressing it as forcefully as possible.
Well, Father Jim Martin, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a Jesuit priest, culture editor of America Magazine, author of a number of books, and he's been a guest on this program in the past. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Jessica Crocker is our intern, and Kevin Griffin, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder, along with Sophie Reed today. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.